and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a discussion of progressive issues of faith and action, coming to you in the 75th anniversary year of WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and WESUFM.org, and repeated on UConn's WHUS 91.7 FM stores and WHUS.org, UConn's Radio for the People. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, one woman's story of addiction, crime, prison, and grace and redemption. I first met Cindy Cloney when she spoke this fall at an event sponsored by the Archdiocese of Hartford's Office for Catholic Social Justice. It was about over-incarceration. This is part one of a two-part Reasonably Catholic series on this subject. The next will feature Brian Moran, an attorney and author of the book The Justice Imperative, How Hyper-Incarceration Has Hijacked the American Dream. Cindy Cloney's three-year prison sentence was the result of a crime that she didn't tell us about that night at St. Peter Claver Church in West Hartford. But now she does tell us in this interview, and as you'll hear, it comes as something of a surprise to me. I mention this because my surprise actually is part of the problem, that we have expectations of what certain kinds of crimes and criminals are like. Interestingly, the New York Times just had a big front page spread this Sunday about this very subject. Stay tuned for what will be a fast-moving hour of honesty and insights from someone who brings us to a place few of us have seen from the inside. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. Thanks for listening. Back in a moment.
It's a medical breakthrough, a doctor's prescription to help prevent cancer and improve survival rates. But you don't go to the pharmacy, you go to the supermarket for fruits, vegetables, and other high-fiber vegetarian foods. Side effects may include increased energy, healthy weight loss, and lower cholesterol. For a free recipe booklet, call 866-906-WELL or visit cancerproject.org. This message brought to you by the Cancer Project, committed to preventing cancer and improving survival.
Up next, Cindy Cloney, talking about her drug addiction, the crime she committed, and the prison sentence that resulted, and how it set her on a new path. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM stores.
I've seen the needle and the damage done, a little part of it in everyone, but every junkie's like a setting sun.
Welcome, Cynthia Cloney.
Hi, Maria. How are you?
May I call you Cindy?
Sure.
You and I first met at St. Peter Claver Church in West Hartford, where you were part of a presentation on over-incarceration. Mm-hmm. That was sponsored by the Archdiocese of Hartford's Office for Catholic Social Justice Ministry, where Lynn Campbell does such a great job. Mm-hmm. Little shout out to Lynn.
Go, Lynn.
So, you know, we progressive-minded Catholics are concerned about the death penalty. But really, that might be as far as our interest in the prisons goes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know there are good Catholic folk who visit people in the prisons, but this subject of over-incarceration, it's not exactly a household term.
No, you don't hear too much about it.
And maybe we should start with how you came to be something of an expert on the subject.
Oh, an expert. Thank you.
What's your story, Cindy?
Well, I know incarceration firsthand because I was incarcerated back in 2007. I spent 3 years at York Correctional for Women after a long battle with addiction and all the things that go with it. And I ended up, you know, committing a crime that got me, a 42-month sentence up there.
May I be so personal as to ask what the crime was?
Sure. It was bank robbery, believe it or not. Yeah, I was.
I'm Sorry. That is just so surprising. Look at you. You do not look like your folks, she's just this lovely, I would say maybe 40-something gal with a lovely haircut and a nice white sweater, you know, one of those lovely Irish knit sweaters over a turtleneck and jeans, and she just does not look like those people you see. Of course not.
Those people.
So, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was at the end of a very long battle, like I said, and, you know.
You were desperate.
Yes.
You needed money for drugs.
Exactly. And, you know, when you have nothing left, you have nothing left to lose, and that's where I was at the time.
Were you armed?
No.
And that's why you were not. You're not still in prison.
Right. I probably would have gotten a lot longer. I mean, they did want me to do a lot longer, but I had, you know, my backstory was such that, you know, I was able at least to have a judge that was fair and listened to, you know, what I had done my life prior to the crime. Like, I wasn't just my crime. There was a whole other life back here, another person.
What was that like?
Well, I mean, I was a nurse. I owned a home. You know, I worked very hard, sometimes 2-3 jobs. And then I...
Was the nursing somehow dovetailing with the drug addiction because you had access?
It definitely perpetuated it because I did have access. And I never, sadly, never got caught, you know, taking any kind of drugs, you know. And
why do you say sadly?
Well, because I think that it could have maybe stopped some, you know, stopped this in the process if maybe I had been called out on it. I don't know. Who knows? You know, hindsight's 20/20. Could always go back and try to, you know, fix the picture, but it doesn't change anything. So, you know, there was access, of course, to narcotics and whatnot. But I had stopped nursing, which was a blessing. I had stopped in 2004. You know, I had started using heroin 2001.
Heroin.
Yeah, well, I had graduated. I had graduated from the pain pills to heroin, and then, you know, it was all downhill after that.
Wow.
And yeah, it was quite a downward spiral, you know, if I can say that. But
God, you've been through something.
Yeah, but I'm also 7 years clean and sober now. So, I mean, I'm on the flip side of it all, and, you know, life is pretty amazing, like this. You know, that's why. Yeah, I'm dressed like a school teacher. Maybe I was the inner school teacher, me or nurse me, whatever. But in 2007, I ended up getting, you know, like I said, nothing left. House was foreclosed. I had lost everything. My family basically had to turn their backs because I was just I was really, really, really a mess.
And when you say your family, who do you mean?
Well, my parents, my sisters, my grandmother, you know, my poor grandmother, she took the brunt of it all because I was staying with her at the time. You know, I had nowhere to live. And
how old were you?
Back in 2007, I was 37.
So, no kids?
No, okay. No, I didn't have any children. All right. Thank God, that would have been more collateral damage. But
I want to ask, only because you mentioned it at the event, you grew up Catholic.
Yes, yes. I went to church from the time I was, you know, all the sacraments up till confirmation, Catholic school. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But did that have any part in
at the time of, you know, when I was on my... When I was doing the drugs, couldn't say I was a practicing Catholic. Mm. You know, I basically had no religion, no spirituality at the time. The drugs were, you know, that was filled my spiritual void at the time. And that's where the trouble was. That was the inner turmoil, you know what I mean? Because there was that hole that wasn't getting filled by anything. And that, you know, the heroin, as people that are addicts will tell you, I mean, it fills. It gives you that warm and fuzzy feeling, you know, that good, that hug that you need around you, that, you know, it's scary. It's really, really scary.
Not to pursue it too far, but I'm just wondering about when you very, very first started on drugs, it was to fill a void, or was it just like for fun because it's the weekend? Or,
well, you know, I grew up in a town where there was, you know, very little activities. You know, for us growing up, basically it was hanging out, drinking. You know, we started, my friends and myself, we started very young, 14, or so, you know, drinking, stealing from the parents' liquor cabinet. And then, you know, then somebody says, here, try this, smoke, you know, smoking some pot. And it progressed from there, you know. And but
just whole, recreational.
Recreational. You know, I graduated school, went to college, whatever, whatever. So, I mean, I just basically was, you know, maybe at the time a functioning addict before I knew what the term was. Who knows? But as I got older and stuff, you know, I think that that hole was getting bigger and bigger. You know, it may have been smaller when I was smaller, but then I was getting older, it got bigger. And there was nothing that filled it. But then I had a surgery. Very, you know, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, but it was innocuous, maybe the word. I didn't realize it. Started taking the Percocets that were prescribed to me. And, oh, it was like, wow, this feels great. You know, not only did it alleviate my physical pain, any emotional, spiritual, other pain was gone as well.
Fascinating.
Okay. It is. That's the progression of it. You know what I mean? For people that do have the bent for it, that like that feeling, or that are missing that real inner, you know, peaceful feeling, that provides a temporary false, you know, fix for it. So.
And then, like you say, it progressed to the point where you were so desperate, you committed a crime.
Mm-hmm.
You land in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
York Correctional, the only women's facility in Connecticut. I had to, they caught me in Florida because I had left the state.
So you robbed the bank and you hightailed it to
Florida. I hit the road, yeah. So I was brought back like as a fugitive. Oh, yeah. Went all the way.
Wow.
Yeah.
At any point in that drama, did you kind of step away and look at yourself and go, you know, you are not the person you think you are, you know?
Well, I could say, yes, I did, mostly when I was probably withdrawing from the heroin. Because when you're doing the drugs, all that goes away. You know, once you get that, once that fix comes, all that thinking of like, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah.
You know, that goes away because you feel just peaceful.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like that false sense of security. So I really didn't have a lot of time for self-reflection, though I knew, after, you know, August of 2007 that the end was near. I knew it.
Because at what point in things was that?
That was, well, August 17th, 2007 was the first robbery. I did three of them. I went on like a little spree.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. So you actually succeeded at this.
Well, I wouldn't call it a success.
You did two, but enough to do three, you know.
Well, you know, when you get away with one, it's like anything else. You know, you get it, kind of, you lose your fear for it and stuff.
So you
No, go ahead.
Well, you walk up to the teller and you hand a note mm-hmm. that says, give me all your money?
Something similar to that. It was more like, you know, just, I had a bag with me, and I was like, just fill the bag. Don't put any of that dye money in there, and I'm out.
You're listening to an interview with Cindy Cloney, who's working to get her life back on track after her journey through drug addiction and incarceration. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, on 88.1 FM Middletown, now celebrating its 75th year of providing community radio that matters, and rebroadcast on WHUS 91.7 FM Stores, Yukon's radio for the people. Thanks for listening. Back in a moment.
Sure, humans can be a little weird at times, but take it from me, I'm a dog. And a person is about the best thing that can happen to a shelter pet. So if you want to learn how you can be that person, get down to your local pet shelter or visit theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Sick. I was dope sick. And
wow.
It was my last resort because.
Did you disguise yourself?
Yeah, not great, but I did. I didn't walk. I mean, I was also about 30 pounds thinner than I am now because I was, you know, emaciated from the drugs and the lifestyle. But I had a bit of a disguise, and it was August, so I was pretty obvious with my big heavy coat on and, you know, my hair up, and I had long blonde hair and, you know, glasses, but I was kind of It was a pseudo disguise. It wasn't great. Mm-hmm. But you know what, Maria, by that point, I didn't care.
Yeah.
It didn't matter to me because, you know, I knew this was going nowhere, this whole lifestyle. You know, when you look at your home, you know, which was a family home, you know, you look at all the things that, you know, I lost. When I tell you everything, I mean, I'm down to my dogs. I lost. You know, I had two, you know, dogs. Of course, I don't have kids, so they're like my little kids. And, you know, once that's all gone, you know what I mean? It's amazing how fearless you get
right.
when you have nothing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Freedom's just another word for
nothing left to lose. Mm-hmm. And that's where I was back then. You know, I was at the end of a very long, dead relationship that just did not refuse to die. You know what I mean? It was almost like I had a relationship. How could I put it? A relationship cancer that, you know, wouldn't go away. Mm. And, you know, this person was the one that I ended up with, you know, was my co-defendant.
So also an addict.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You know, clean now, thank goodness.
Okay. Oh, good.
Like myself. You know, we're both, you know, we're doing our thing. He's got.
And you're both together still?
No. Hell no. I didn't. Oh, excuse me. I was supposed to say that on a Catholic show?
That's fine. We're a progressive Catholic show.
Okay, good.
We can say those things.
Okay. Thank you. But no, we shouldn't have been together back then. But it was a case where, like, the drugs held us together and the lifestyle held us together. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It was easier to just stay than it was to try to break free and move on to a new thing. The fear was there as far as, like, you know, I know what this is here. I have this you know, comfort zone, which is not a comfort zone at all. But it distorts your whole pattern of thinking.
How much did you steal, just for the record?
Enough to get me 42 months in prison. Yeah. How about that?
Did you go straight to your dealer?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and you bought like...
Yeah, I bought... We had a... it was terrible. We had a party. You know, we did. Everybody was happy that day.
Sorry for laughing.
No, but that's what it was. It was like after I, you know, after it happened, that's what I did. Exactly. That was the next move was to call and get the, you know, the stuff that was going to make me feel well again. And
did you see yourself on the news?
I didn't, no. But everybody else did.
And recognized you?
My father did. He did. My mother was in denial, I think. But my my father's like, oh, my God. He goes, that's her. Because I was, you know, at the time, remember, I was estranged from my family. So I really wasn't, you know, seeing them on a regular basis. And they knew something was wrong because, you know, as you could see, I'm pretty healthy. But I was like down to 100
you
pounds.
You look no worse for the wear.
Well, back then I did. Back then I was really like, I looked like, you know, I could
have. Classic addict.
Yes. You know, like skinny and gaunt looking and very drawn, pale and whatnot and stuff. And they knew. My father knew. He knew.
It must have broken his heart.
Yeah, but I think that, you know what? They were so grateful that I got arrested because they were waiting for the other phone call to come identify my body.
Oh, God.
And, you know, that's what my mother told me when she saw me. I hadn't seen them in a while. When I got arrested, like I said, I was down in Florida, and I waited 3 weeks there to get extradited back to Connecticut. So when I saw my mother, you know, at the arraignment, I hate to say this. She goes, when I first saw them, when they came to visit me, like on my first visit that I could get over at York, they're like, we're just so grateful that you're here. They said, because we were waiting for that other phone call.
So was it in prison that your withdrawal, is that what we say, began?
Yes. I went through that in Florida because I spent 3 weeks there and it was horrific. You know, every time you withdraw, it's horrible. You know, I can't, it's the worst flu. Plus anxiety, you know, just figure you have the flu, plus you're having, you know, a week-long panic attack that never ends. That's what it feels like.
Richards spends a lot of pages in his memoir describing various withdrawals.
Does he?
And it's hell on wheels from the sound of it.
It is, because it, you know, not only, like I said, there's that physical component, then you have the psychological component that comes in. And you start to relive all the dirty deeds that you, you know, did and whatnot. And it's just an overall icky feeling, you know. And you are sick. I mean, you're in pain, you're throwing up. And
you're in a hotel room?
No, I was in a jail.
Oh, right, waiting to be extradited.
I was waiting, yeah. They had me locked up at Hillsborough County Jail.
So there wasn't a period in Florida where you were not yet captured?
There was, but it was very short. You know, it was a very short-lived freedom from the last one, from the last robbery, which, like I said, I mean, it turned out to be a backhanded grace, all of it, because, yeah. There was no way. I overdosed, I don't know, 2-3 times maybe, came back, got back here. And, I think that if I had kept going, it was just a matter of time.
I'm just curious what kind of compassion, if any, is shown toward a heroin addict withdrawing when they're in prison?
Very little. Yeah. Very little. Basically,
they didn't give you methadone.
No, that's only, they do it for pregnant women or people that are already on methadone, but they won't give just the regular, unless there's a really
writhing there.
Yeah, and the thing is, the ironic part is you won't die from withdrawal. You don't die from heroin withdrawal. Alcohol withdrawal, benzodiazepine withdrawal, you could die from that. But heroin, no. You just want to die. You feel like you're going to die, but you don't die.
So they're like, she'll get over it.
She'll get over it. 3-4 days, after you're out of your fetal position, you'll be all right. And that's how it was, too. About a week, a week into it, I got up. I showered, because I didn't want to do anything at that point. I barely got up to use the bathroom. But I had, previous to that, back in March of 2007, I had actually, at the time, I had moved to Florida. See, the story is, like I said, there's more of a backstory to it. I'm not going to get into it, but I had moved to Florida. Moved to Florida in March. 2006, something like that. But then I had left Florida to go stay with a friend in Maryland, and I kicked then, and I kicked cold turkey. Now, that was even harder because I had really not gotten clean prior to that, so that was really hard. That was my first real experience with, just kicking hardcore. I've been dope sick before, but then, of course, somebody comes over, you get money, whatever. But this time I was in that was like, that was an experience because, I had gotten a taste of the sober life for about a month. I had met some great people down there. I'd started going to NA meetings. As soon as I could get up and stand straight again, I started going to meetings. I met a great sober network. And then, I don't know, something pulled me back. You know what I mean? Like the lifestyle pulled me back.
How hard.
Yeah, it's relapse. It's part of the process.
Wow.
I hate to say it. But then that led to me coming back to Connecticut in June. And then committing the robberies in August. So that's the...
One after another.
It was one after the other. Yeah. It was all in a matter of 3 weeks' time. Because, you get this money, but that money's... when you have a habit that's $100 to $200 a day, and you're feeding, a bunch of people, hangers-oners, with you, there's, that doesn't go far. I had $100 to $200 a day habit at the time.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that money did not go far.
This is an interview with Cynthia Cloney talking about her 3-year prison sentence and where she is today. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs. So, all right, fast forward, you're in jail.
Mm-hmm.
What's that like? Is this an Orange is the New Black kind of thing? Do you feel like?
Well, I never watched Orange is the New Black. I read the book, and a lot of it is, there's some that's true. There's some of it that's kind of,
it's kind of based on York, isn't it?
No, it's based on, she was in a federal prison. She wasn't in state prison. There's a difference between the feds and the state.
Okay.
They say that, I've never been in federal prison, so I can't speak from experience, but state prison is like a stripped down version of, everything is basic. The food is disgusting. You know what I mean?
It's the lowest bidder.
The lowest, yeah, everything. I worked in the kitchen when I was there, so I know what they served, and whatnot. But I'll tell you what, it was a transformation for me. It was like, I'll say again, another one of those backhanded graces, because by that point, I wanted to be clean and couldn't. Couldn't get there, couldn't get into a program because either I had, no insurance or no money or not enough this or they didn't take this kind, whatever.
Right.
It was always a reason why, or there was a long waiting list, whatever. So when I got caught and got you know, got sent to York, you know, granted I had to, you know, white knuckle it through the withdrawal in Florida and then come back and start dealing with all the deeper stuff and the damage that I had done and the family, you know, the relationships with my family and my friends and my community and everything and like that. So that was a whole other process that kicked in after I came back to Connecticut. But luckily, I met the most wonderful human being up there by the name of Dennis Dolan, Deacon Dennis Dolan, the Catholic chaplain. He just retired after 20 years up there, and it's going to be a sad loss for those women. Let me tell you what, there's no real counseling up there, okay, which is sad because there really should be. You know, there's just some kind of like, you know, fluff counseling. But I was able to go talk to him every week. He said, you know, he always put it out there to people. He said, hey, you know, I'm in my office from such and such a time. I'll give you a pass because you need a pass to go anywhere. He said, I'll give you a pass if you want to, you know, come and talk. And I had gone to Catholic services because I had reconnected with, you know, with my faith and, you know, my spirituality and stuff like that. Because they say, you know, there's no atheists in foxholes or in prison, right? But seriously, you know, even up until then, I knew in my heart, you know, that God, my God was, you know, he had my back, but, you know, was not happy with the situation. You know what I'm saying? And I was the one that was like that little, you know, that kid, like, ooh, you know, I'm in trouble, yeah, type thing. But when I got to York, I realized that, you know, it wasn't the way I saw it. And, you know, Deacon Dolan showed me that, you know. He put it into a different perspective. Because the Catholic religion I remember growing up was, you know, thou shalt not, you know, don't do this or you're going to get this, you're going to be punished, you know. And you know, that I didn't need that at the time because, yeah, I was, you know, you can't
doing enough of that on your
right?
own.
Right, I took care of that, you know. Right. So, but he put a totally different spin on it, and I went to go see him every week, and you know, just little by slowly, you know, with that, and then I pushed and pushed and pushed to get into some kind of, you know, groups and AA meetings, NA meetings. Now, you would think that with like 90% of the people, the women in New York, being on some kind of, having some kind of substance issue, there'd be NA, AA meetings every day.
There aren't.
One a week, and everybody wants to go to them.
Wow.
One on each side. Yeah. There's one on the west side, which is the maximum security side, and one on the east side, which is the minimum security side. And it took me months of writing to get in to go. And then I finally went, and I went faithfully. And, you know, did all the relapse prevention. I did as many groups as I could just to figure out, okay, what, you know, what's wrong with my head here?
Yeah.
You know, why do I think the way I do? And, you know, luckily, here I am. I'm sitting here today.
Wow.
You know?
So what is it about the mission you're on? Why did you, what did you see? You must have seen something at York that made you feel like, you know what, this is not the right way to deal with these people.
Well, yes. I mean, in York and in the world in, at large, because, you know, if I could just take a minute.
Sure.
We're having a huge heroin epidemic in this country. I don't know if anybody realizes this, but I just talked to my friend in Baltimore yesterday, my friend Stuart, he's a dear friend of mine, and the governor-elect of Maryland went around the whole state of Maryland from up into the mountains down to the shore and asked people in, you know, selected towns, what's the biggest problem? You know what they said? Heroin. And I'll tell you what, it's the same up here in the Northeast. And we better get a grip on it soon because, you know, the ends, like they say in AA, are jails, institutions, or death. And that's what's going to, you know, you have a whole younger generation that's using this very, very potent narcotic. I mean, there's none stronger. You know what I mean? And if we don't get a handle on this whole situation, I hate to see what it's going to be like about 10 years from now. And, you know, most of the women that are in York are, I won't say heroin addicts, but they're, you know, they have addictive behaviors to whatever, you know, their drug of choices, their behavior, you know, whatever it is, shopping or whatever the case may be. You know what I mean?
And also a history of having been abused.
History of abuse. Add that in the mix.
What did you tell me the percentage of people is in the...
95%
of women in York were... Sexually abused?
Sexually abused. I mean, it also encompasses other abuse, like domestic violence and, you know,
yeah,
I guess just growing up, having verbal, physical abuse, you know, a family that's broken, whatever the case may be, you know.
And these women, I imagine they were in for prostitution, for what other kinds?
Larceny, like shoplifting was huge. Larceny, whatever the amount was, it goes 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and one being the highest amount. A lot of that, you know, they called them boosters. You know, they'd go into stores and steal to, you know, support their habit. Prostitutes, most definitely. And, you know, I mean, they get, their time incarcerated is very short, so they don't get access to a lot of the programs that
Interesting.
Are in there.
So they're in and out. Like a
skid bids, they call them. 90 days, six months maybe.
And then after a little while out, they're back.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing changes, nothing changes. So, yeah. I mean, if they come in and they're not doing any kind of, you know, self-awareness work, we'll say, you know, or just trying to, you know, some of them don't want to change. I mean, why? There's no incentive for them to change, really, or they don't know anything else besides the life that they're living. Yeah. And, you know, inside York, you know, it kind of perpetuates the behavior, you know what I mean? Because it's just...
Interesting.
Yeah, it perpetuates it. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, no, don't.
Well, I don't want to get too much into it because there's investigations going on, allegations of abuse and whatnot up there.
Ah,
but it's,
so you're saying it's not part of the solution.
It's part of the problem. Mm-hmm. It is because, you know, I mean, when you're feeding into these negative behaviors, you know, with positive reinforcement, what are you going to get? You know, nothing's going to change. And
so
we're only as sick as our secrets. And that's another thing. I quote a lot from AA and the Big Book and whatnot because, you know, I read it a couple times in my life. And it's true, you know, only as sick as our secrets. And, you know, sexual abuse in people's lives is usually a secret. That doesn't usually come out to the forefront because it's so difficult to deal with.
Right.
When you do finally, you know, come to grips with it and say, oh, my God, you know, you have to have something to after you've totally come unglued because of it. You need to have something to put you back together again.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what's lacking. Once it comes to the light, you know, they say if you bring stuff to the light, though, it loses its power over you.
Right, right.
You know, but some people, you know, not everybody has the emotional capability and the, you know, psychological fortitude, I guess, to say, to deal with that.
You're listening to an interview with Cindy Cloney, who's working to get her life back on track after her journey through drug addiction and incarceration. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith on WESU 88.1 FM Middletown, now celebrating its 75th year of providing community radio that matters and rebroadcast on WHUS 91.7 FM Stores, Yukon's radio for the people. Thanks for listening.
Death of me.
Did you feel like you were different from those people in York?
I wouldn't say so much different, but I didn't. I kept to myself.
Ah.
I kept to myself because I had a mission. I was gonna fix this.
Yeah,
I mean, I wasn't your young. I was 37 when I went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't like, you know, 21 years old. So I had a different mindset. You know, I had a lot of years of living ahead of me, behind me. I mean, and you know, I was at almost the halfway mark. So I was like, at one point, I'm like, is this what your life is going to be?
Right.
You know, is this what you want? I had to do some heavy, heavy soul searching and figure that no, this is not what I want. So I stayed away from the fray. You know, I didn't get involved in all the drama because, you know, you get a bunch of women together and you got nothing but drama. You know what I mean? And then you get a staff that, you know, feeds off of it and you got yourself a whole, you know, soap opera. So I stayed away from it and just did my thing. I went to school. I earned a culinary certificate. I took a culinary. I got to eat very, very well for
very
9 months.
Smart.
It was wonderful, yes. And, you know, I worked. I kept my nose to the grindstone. I worked my whole time I was there. I was lucky enough to be one of four. There was 4 out of 1,000 of us that got to go and work off grounds under supervision.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of the lucky ones that got to go for the last year that I was there. And I was able to go and reintegrate with society and you know, be around people again. Because, you know, for 3 years, I was just around COs and volunteers and, you know, other inmates. I wasn't around, you know, normal people, quote, quote.
Yeah, quote is right.
What is normal, right?
So by the time you were done with your sentence, you felt pretty ready to go out into the world.
I was, I had tools, you know, mm-hmm. I had coping skills that I never had before. I was, you know, of course, sober for 3 years, so, mm-hmm. you know, had
that
done.
That helps.
It did help. It helped. And plus, I was lucky. I had a good family waiting for me. You know, right. Not everybody has that. You know, they go out into
the void.
Yes, and there's broken relationships that haven't been repaired. There's, you know, like I said, the collateral damage, families, children,
yeah.
you know, so I'm blessed as far as that goes. My family welcomed me back.
So even though you're done and it's behind you, a part of you is still concerned.
Yeah, I am. And, you know, I say I'm doing God's work. This is what I'm, you know, it's more or less I'm being, you know, propelled by the Spirit, not so much, you know, like as far as on a mental cognitive level, yes, I understand it, but it's more like I'm being called to do this kind of work.
And what does that require of you? You go and speak.
I go and speak, and like I went, I just graduated. I finished the drug and alcohol recovery counselor program.
Oh, great!
I just finished that in May, so I'm
congratulations.
Thank you. I'll be hopefully. Well, what I'm doing now is trying to get my nursing license back, so that's taking a little bit of time because I have to, you know, I have to prove to the state that I'm not going to be that I'm in fit enough mental, physical shape that I could, you know, handle being a nurse again. Which, of course, you know, you have to be in. You have to take care of yourself.
You miss it.
I do, because I think that, you know, I didn't appreciate it when I had it. And then when I lost it and my whole life went upside down, that's when I realized that, whoa, you know, I think that's what I'm supposed to be, my true calling. But this all goes part and parcel with that, because it's all about healing.
All right.
Do you know what I mean? It's right. in healing the whole person. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think that's where, I'm not sure where it's going to lead. I just show up to where I'm asked to go.
So what should happen? We won't take the world or the country. We'll take Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
What should be done differently?
What should be done differently? Well, more emphasis on treatment and restorative justice rather than punitive.
Does that mean not sending people to jail at all? I mean, jail was pretty much the best thing that ever happened to you.
Well, in my case, yes. But, you know, you got to remember, too, the punishment had to fit the crime. You know, I my lawyer told me something that I'll never forget. I said, but I never got arrested in my life. He said, well, you picked a heck of a place to start. You know what I mean? So I
No, what did he mean by that?
Meaning like if
Is Connecticut
I,
a
Well, because of the severity of, you know, bank robbery. It's
oh,
you know
he
what
meant
I mean?
You picked quite the crime.
Yes. And, you know, instead of starting like boosting from a store or whatever. I went right to that.
Right into the deep end.
Right into it. I jumped. I didn't even, like, I didn't put my toe in the water. I just went, you know, bonsai. And that was
well,
it.
That's where the money is.
That's exactly. That was exactly what I said. Right? That made perfect sense in my mind.
Aww.
Perfect sense. But, yeah, so what were you talking about?
Well, we're wondering now, you think people are over-incarcerated. What should be done differently? We should what?
Well, I wish I had an answer. I can give you what I... You know, what I'm finding as I, you know, go along in my travels and speaking to other people and stuff. Number one is we have to increase the amount of treatment available. Okay. Not saying that, like I said before, you're not trying to coddle. You don't want to, like, you know, you're not coddle people, but these people are coming in, and I speak for women. I'm sure men have, you know, they're similar issues to women, but the women are coming in sick. You know what I mean? They're sick in the soul. They're sick in their body. You know what I mean? So you bring them in, you fatten them up on this, you know, this horrible food. You know what I mean? Let them lay around. It's a strange microcosm of society. That's all I could say. But what I'm thinking in my, like I said, in my research and whatnot, is that other states they have alternatives to incarceration. You know what I mean? They have
so for a first offender, for instance.
First offender treatment. Yeah. Second offense, treatment. You know what I mean? Like, because when you're trying to battle something like an addiction, a lot of times you're not going to get it on the first try. Mm-hmm. You know, many people that I know that have gotten clean and sober, including myself, you don't get it on the first try.
Well, you have to want the treatment, and not everyone does.
You're right.
So how are we going to deal?
You're right. You're right. I don't know. That's a good question, because you can't make somebody. You can only lead a horse to water.
Yeah.
I know. I don't know. I wish I knew. If I knew, I'd patent it, and yeah. I'd be, you know.
But when you go around and people ask you about this, what do you tell them as far as what we can do, you know?
That's a good question. What do I tell them? I tell them my story. And, you know, I'm no expert on the subject, believe me, by no stretch of the imagination. All I know is that, the people that come into prison, I'll say it once again, the people that I met at York, for the most part, were broken. Okay. So do you want to send somebody back out into society as broken as they were when they came in? Or would you want to send somebody out there that at least, you know, has some better coping skills and better tools to manage their life and become a productive member of society? Which person do you want to release back into society?
So it sounds like what you're saying, if you have to incarcerate the person for whatever reason, then at least try to treat them.
Instead of looking at people like basis of a crime, okay, you have to look at that person and see, like I said, find out that backstory. You know what I mean? This person could have been abused their whole life. You know what I mean? And this is the manifestation of all that abuse, okay? A life of crime, whatever. From the time they were kids, they were being, you know, molested by a relative or something, God forbid. You know, why not try to help that person deal with that rather than just, you know, shoving them into a 10x12 cell, letting them sit there, lay on their bed and do nothing, or encourage them to try to, you know, maybe make some positive changes in their life. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying?
And give them more opportunities.
More opportunities.
But you learned how to cook. I mean, it sounds like there are opportunities.
Well, there are opportunities, but they're limited.
Ah.
They're very limited. You know what I mean? And you have to...
So you're seeing a lot of people kind of just lying around, and it strikes you as a waste of time and money, a waste of talent, wastefulness.
Yes, lots of it, of it. And, you know, I mean, it's not, like you said before, it's all up to the individual, ultimately, and with anything, you know what I mean? You can't force it on somebody. And if you do, I've seen it where it was forced on people, and it didn't have the impact that if it did on somebody that really wanted it. Like, I had some friends, I met some of the most amazing, amazing people up there, if you can believe that. I mean, some of them are my dear friends to this day. You know, these women, you know, they all had something that was kind of, you know, that led them to where they were and stuff like that. Now, just imagine, like, multiply that by 1,000, okay? And if you could just have the tools and resources available for these people, do you know what I mean, to tap into, what could it do? You know, I mean, we all the women that I've met there that I'm still friends with, we've all done 180s with our lives. Do you know what I mean? We've all kind of, you know, saw, like, hey, this isn't working, you know, but we wanted it. So you're right about that. It's the whole thing. But how do you get somebody to want something that they don't even know they're really missing?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm, of course, you know, obviously, you see, I'm white, I'm middle-aged, and I'm a woman. So I have, you know, a different, like, I didn't grow up in Hartford. I didn't grow up in Bridgeport and stuff like that. I grew up in suburbia. So I have a different perspective on things. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it's hard. I wish I had a better answer for you.
But have you been back to the...
No, I can't go back yet. Not until I'm cleared of, you know, all my everything.
You can't even go back and visit.
No.
That's like a law?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, it's an unwritten law. It's something that DOC, you know, kind of frowns upon. They don't like people that have been incarcerated really to, you know, mingle with people who are, for whatever reason. I don't know if they're worried that, you know, maybe people are corrupted and they want to, you know, bring in contraband per se and stuff.
Wow.
That, I mean, that's not my MO, but I'm sure it's been done because somebody must have gotten caught. I'm sure. So, yeah, no, not yet. I mean, I'm hoping someday to be able to. I do my work on the outside. You know, I do it on the outside.
What do you do for a living?
Well, right now I work at a restaurant. I'm a waitress, and I'm waiting to start school again, and then I'll be going to go back and take a refresher course, take the nursing boards again, and see what happens. And then I don't know.
I'm I have God's a good feeling humor. About this.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Because it changes for me from day to day. No, all in all, it's a positive. Everything's a positive. You know, I wake up every day, you know, and clean and sober on my own power that, you know, it's not much else can bother me.
This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU 88.1 FM Middletown and rebroadcast on the University of Connecticut's WHUS 91.7 FM Storrs.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around the bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on.
Listen, I live moment to moment. I live for the now. I don't think about yesterday too much, only if we're, you know, like now we're making points and we're talking and I'm telling you my story. But I try not to live in the past. I try to live right here, right now. Because really, if you think about it, what else do we have? You know what I mean?
That's right. The present moment.
The present moment. Tomorrow's not here yet. Tomorrow and yesterday only exist in your mind. The moment, the present, is like right here. Jeez. Sorry.
It's okay. Are you a little bit Italian, maybe?
Oh, my God. I'm almost all Italian. Can you tell? Oh, my God.
It's only the Italians that whack the microphone and the table.
Oh, yeah. Because we talk with our hands. Right. If you had to tie my hands on, I don't know what to say.
It's part of your charm.
It's part of my, oh, yeah.
Do you keep in touch with your friend, the deacon?
Yes, I did for a while, and I will be getting in touch with him again. He just, like I said, he just retired, so I'm letting him enjoy his freedom.
You should make sure he hears your shout out to him.
He got paroled, so I want him to enjoy it. You know.
Yeah. Well, he did some good work.
Oh my goodness, I couldn't be as I wouldn't have gotten as far so quickly if it wasn't for him.
What can you think of any of the wise things he told you that kind of took?
Oh, God, there was...
You say he had a different perspective on the faith.
He did. You know, he'd call us God's girl and, you know, like, basically saying, you know, would be, though you know you committed this crime, you know what I mean? God still loves you. He's forgiven you, so you need to forgive you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because if God can do it.
Right? Who are you not to, really? Yeah. So, I mean, it was little isms like that. I wish I could remember them. You know, they were so profound that they just kind of became a part of me, you know, and I lived like that. He used to give us the Walmart blessing. It was the funniest thing. You know, we'd go to church every week, and if somebody was leaving, he would give a shout out from the pulpit and be like, okay, we got to give so-and-so, they're leaving, let's give them the Walmart blessing. Hope to see you in Walmart, not back here, you know what I mean? And it was the greatest thing because, I mean, we laughed at church. I don't ever remember laughing at church my whole life. You know, we used to call the church on the west side Our Lady of the Loading Dock because that's where it was, on the loading dock. Folding chairs set up. Yeah. Our Lady of the Loading Dock.
Wow.
The other side, we had a chapel. We had a nice chapel, actually. I actually sang in the choir, as scary as that sounds.
Why would that be scary?
Oh, because you never heard me sing.
Wow.
So, but yeah, but he was just, God, I wish I had some great, great words of wisdom I could give you. I wish he was here. Yeah. But yeah, no, it was just the fact that I think he gave me that sense of, like, you know, I'm not judging you.
Yeah.
Basically what he was saying, you know, I'm like, I'm not here to judge you. You know, and I was able to, you know, get that impression from him right off the bat. Because
he sees you as a person.
He did. And he's, I mean, you got to figure too, he's seeing everybody. Like, and we're all in different levels of, you know, of...
Your journeys.
Yes, most definitely. And he's seen it all. And he's very non-judgmental and just very, you could feel the love from him. Not, you know, in just a positive, you know, caring way. You know, and then there's not, you know, you gotta figure there's not a lot of whole heck of a lot of that going around in a jail. You know what I mean?
Right. Wow.
But yeah, so he's great. But there's, I mean, he's not the only one. I had a lot of great experiences up there. I mean, I've met Reverend Valerie Dixon. She's from the Episcopal Church. You know, do you know Valerie Dixon?
No.
She's wonderful. And she was another person, too. I mean, there was countless volunteers that would come in and just volunteer their time so these programs could actually be available to us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to definitely give a shout out to them, because if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have stuff like Houses of Healing, where we could delve into spirituality, and, you know, the People Empowering People program, which is a great program, which Cherry Zuba helped put together for the women's prison and stuff. I mean, and the men's too, I believe. You know, it's just people like that, you know, doing God's work is what I call it. Because, you know, like Jesus said, you can't forget about the people in prison. You minister to the sick, you feed the hungry, you clothe the naked. You know what I mean? Like, and that's what I think that in this country we're forgetting. You know, we're losing that. We're losing sight of that because we're so me. I. It's a selfish world we live in, you know. And I think that, you know, I always... I was talking to my friend Stuart yesterday, you know, and we were discussing this whole situation because, you know, he's in recovery as well. And, you know, most addicts are sensitive people to begin with. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Overly sensitive in a lot of ways. And that's how I was.
Yeah.
You know, I saw, like, anytime, like, somebody got hurt or somebody was in pain or something, I felt it. You know what I mean? Like, it was almost like me going through it, you know?
Yeah.
And the drugs made that tolerable. You know, but now... You know, fast forward 7 years, you know, I can understand that, you know, it's not about me. Do you know what I mean? Like, you take that self out of the equation.
Yeah.
And you're just, you know, you're an instrument. You just, it's the divine going through. You're a human body, a spiritual being in a human body. That's it. Bottom line.
I am so grateful to have met you.
Really? Oh, thank you. I'm the same. I feel the same. Thank you. Don't hear that often.
Stop. No,
well,
really.
Well, you know, you got to remember, too, the perception of people that are in prison, because there's no face to it. Do you know what I mean? You don't see... It's faceless statistics of crimes, and you only hear about, like, when somebody commits... you know, a horrible crime, or is on parole and does this and blah, blah, blah. What about the stories of success? You don't hear many success stories of people that have come out. And there's plenty. Trust me. There's a lot. Maybe that's where my journey needs to go. I don't know. God put me through, you know, not saying he put me in prison, but you know what? I mean, I was meant to go there for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, not really sure, like, you know, I'm like, really? Did I have to? But yeah, you did. And, you know, like, now I have this in store for you. This is your purpose. We need to find our true purpose in life. You know, why are we here? Doesn't everyone know why you're here? Not just here by accident. There's a reason. Meant to be here to do something, you know, so don't waste your talent.
Well, we're out of time.
Really? I went by quick, huh?
I know.
It was good, though. Thank you for asking me to come on. I appreciate it.
No charge. It's on the house.
Thank you. That's good. Got a lot of bills to pay these days.
You and I are going to talk again.
Okay.
Yeah, I have some thoughts.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Marie. Anytime.
Now the whole damn bus is cheering, and I can't believe I see 100 yellow ribbons around the old.
And that's all for this episode of Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. I wish you a fruitful start of Advent, and I remind you that this is also the start of WESU's Winter Pledge Drive, a chance for you to show the station some love for bringing you such programming as Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith. Thanks for whatever you can give. Please go to the website for details about how to pledge. And also, don't forget to check out ReasonablyCatholic.com, where you'll find audio of 2 years' worth of Reasonably Catholic episodes archived, along with other bells and whistles of interest. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Go Huskies!